how would you describe the objectives and how would you assess the degree to which they've been met?
I think there's a lot of interpretation when you talk about the objectives. I mean, the convention does have words within it which highlight the objectives, but I think because, for example, the phrase outstanding universal value is not defined in the convention, there has been some leeway in trying to interpret in a positive way what that meant as an objective. My interpretation of what the convention is all about is that it's a vehicle, an international treaty, that's the kind of vehicle that it is, that's meant to encourage cooperation among governments around this idea of OUV to better the lot of important heritage places in the world, to improve the levels of conservation attained within these places for their own benefit, but also to, through that effort, to provide models which can influence what goes on in other places, which may never end up on the World Heritage List. I have my own definition of what outstanding universal value is, as everybody does. It's a list of those places that tell stories of such compelling interest that that interest crosses national boundaries. All peoples should share an interest in the survival of those sites and the appreciation of those sites, and all peoples, irrespective of national boundaries, should be willing to take responsibility for the long-term care, long-term stewardship of those sites. So, as an implicit objective, it works against the kind of nationalism which we often see manifest in the decisions of the committee. It's not about which countries can have the most or the best sites on the list. For me, it's really all about how can these countries work together to create a list of sites which are almost stateless, you know, whose presence on the list simply reflects their contribution to human development as opposed to the development of Iran or the development of Brazil. Inevitably, in a political world, it's difficult to separate those sites from the countries. But I think we have to reflect that most of the countries you're talking about have only been in existence for the last 150 years. You know, and most of the heritage we're talking about is much, much older, often much older. And it's this effort to foster forms of cooperation among these countries who have national boundaries, which get them to think big, you know, to look beyond their national boundaries and to say, what do we share? What do we have in common? Which I think gives the convention much of its strength. And in many parts of the world, it's that question, or the ability to frame the question that way, has allowed the experts to sort of overcome some political differences that their masters might have and to find ways to work together at a lower level. So I think what World Heritage does, because it focuses on the celebration of what has outstanding universal value, it gives a positive spin to what we have in common. It gives a positive spin to every group, every community, every nation, every region who are involved with a particular property going on the list, because they can say, we are sharing this with you. And it's yours as well. You know, it's mine, but it's yours.
So your assessment is to, in those terms, that the big picture goals have been met.
The big picture goals have been recognized, and I think are often met. But I think over time, because the convention, like any other legal instrument, is interpreted in different ways, I think it's interpreted today in a much different way than those who looked at it 20 years ago. And there's less, I'm offering you my view of what the convention is all about, but I think there's a less of an interest in that view among many of those who represent their countries at the committee these days. One of the changes that's occurred in a strong way in the last decade or the last 15 years is that the representation of countries has moved from that of the scientific experts. And the convention itself calls for each country to be represented by its best scientific experts in the cultural area or the natural area. Those voices may be present and those people may be present, but they're sitting in the back row, and the person that's taking the microphone is an ambassador, someone with a diplomatic portfolio, a diplomatic mandate, who has trouble dissociating their behavior in other diplomatic forums from the requirements of the World Heritage Convention. So you see, I see in responses, in efforts to get sites on the list, in responses to problems that sites may have, much more nationalism than, you know, than I would see 15 years ago or 20 years ago when I first began to work seriously with the convention. In my view, the advisory bodies have less credibility, less authority than they've ever had. I'm always surprised when I go back and read documents written by Ernest Allen Connolly or Michel Perron in the late 70s, early 80s. They're giving advice to the committee, but they're giving advice with authority. You know, they're saying, we believe strongly that this is the way to go. ICOMOS and IUCN may, and ICROM may continue to say to the committee, we believe strongly in something, but that advice is not taken as seriously these days and is often shunted aside if it conflicts with the particular goals of a country.